director, her voice wavered at the crossroads between shock and disbelief. "I am not at liberty to speak with you further on the subject." Armored feet crossed the room. "If you do see Mistress Durian, sound the alarm at once."
"Of course."
The Knight of the Body left, closing the door behind her. Margaret slid the bolt across and drew the curtains before she hauled Eared from under the bed.
"Eared," she whispered, "what in damsum have you done?"
"I stepped too close to Sabran, just like Loth."
"No,"
Margaret stared at her.
"You used to tread so carefully in this court."
"Eared."
"I know.
Forgive me." She extinguished the candles and stole a look between the curtains. Guards and armed squires were all over the grounds.
"Meg, I need your help. I must return to the Aesir, or Corm will kill me."
"He wouldn't dare. He cannot let me leave the palace alive, not knowing..." Eared faced her again.
"You will hear things about me, things that will make you doubt me. But you must know that I love the queen, and I am certain she is in grave danger.
From the cupbearer,
and her own Duke spiritual. I think they mean to move against her," Eared said.
"Corm has some part in it, I am sure. You must watch Sabran, Meg. Stay close to her."
Margaret searched her face.
"Until you return."
Eared met her expectant gaze. Any promise she made to Margaret now, she might not be able to keep.
"Until I return," she finally said.
This seemed to nerve Margaret. Jaw set, she went to her press and tossed a woolen cloak, a ruffled shirt, and a kirtle onto the bed.
"You won't get far in all that finery," she said. "Fortunate that we are the same height."
Eared stripped to her shift and put on the new clothes, thanking the mother for Margaret Beck. Once the cloak was fastened and the hood up, Margaret led her to the door. Downstairs is a painting of Lady Brilda Glade. There is a stair to the guardhouse behind it. From there, you can circle around the privy gardens to the stables. Take Valor.
That horse was her pride and joy.
"Meg," Eared said, grasping her hands, "they will know you helped me."
"So be it," she pressed a silk purse on Eared. "Here, enough to buy you passage to Zeodur."
"I will remember this kindness, Margaret."
Margaret embraced her so tightly Eared could not breathe.
"I know there is little chance of it," she said thickly. "But if you should meet Loth on the road, I know."
"I love you like my own sister, Eared Durian. We will meet again." She pressed a kiss to her cheek.
"May the saint go with you."
"I know no saint," Eared said honestly, and saw her friend's confusion.
"But I take your blessing, Meg."
She left the chamber and made haste through the corridors, avoiding the guards. When she found the portrait, she descended the stair beyond and emerged in a passage with a window at its end. She hurtled through it and into the night. Inside the royal mews, all was dark. Valor, a gift to Margaret from her father for her 20th birthday, was the envy of every rider at court. He filled the stall at 18 hands. Eared placed a gloved hand on his blood-bay coat. Valor snorted as she saddled him. If rumour had it true, he could outrun even Sabran's horses. Eared wedged her boot into the stirrup, mounted, and snapped the reins. At once, Valor wheeled out of his stall and charged through the open doors. They were through the gates of Ascalon Palace before Eared heard the cry, and by then there was no catching her. Arrows rained in her wake. Valor let out a whinny, but she whispered to him in Selene, urging him on. As the archer stood down, Eared looked back at the place that had been her prison and her home for 8 years. The place where she had met Loth and Margaret, two people she had not expected to befriend. The place where she had grown to care for the seed of the deceiver. The guards came after her. They hunted a ghost, for Eared Durian was no more. She rode hard for 6 days and nights through the sleet, stopping only to rest Valor. She had to stay ahead of the heralds. If Combe had his way, they would already be taking word of her escape through the country. Instead of taking the South Pass, she traversed country lanes and fields. The snow began again on the fourth day. Her journey took her through the bountiful county of the Downs, where Lord and Lady Honeybrook had their seat at Dulcet Court, to the town of Crow Coppice. She watered Valor and filled her wineskin before returning to the road under cover of darkness. She focused on anything but Sabran, but even the swiftest riding left room for thoughts to prey. Now she was sick, she was even more vulnerable than she had been before. As Eared urged the gelding across a farmstead, she damned her own folly. The Innish court had softened her heart.
She could not tell the prioress how it had been with Sabran. Even Chassar might not understand. She hardly understood herself. All she knew was that she could not leave Sabran at the mercy of the Duke's spiritual. When dawn broke on the seventh day, the sea bruised the horizon. To the untaught eye, the cliffs simply fell away, land planing seamlessly into water. One could look at it and never imagine that a city stood between them. Today, smoke betrayed its presence, a thick dark cloud of it billowing skyward. He had watched for a long moment. That was more than chimney smoke. She rode to the edge of the cliffs and surveyed the rooftops below. "Come, Vala," she murmured, and dismounted. She led him to the first set of steps. Perchling was a mess. Cobblestones splashed with blood, bone char and melted flesh oily on the wind. The living wept over the remains of their loved ones or stood in confusion. No one paid any mind to Eard. A dark-haired woman was sitting outside the remains of a bakehouse. "You there," Eard said to her. "What happened here?" The woman was shivering.
"They came in the night. Servants of the High Westerns," she whispered. "The war machines drove them away, but not before they did this."
A tear dripped to her jaw.
"There will be another grief of ages before the year is out."
"Not if I have anything to say about it," Eard said, too softly for her to hear. She took Vala down the stair to the beach. Catapults and other artillery lay wrecked on the sand. Smoking corpses were littered here and there, soldier and worm, tangled in eternal battle, even in death. Cockatrices and basilisks were strewn about in grotesque contortions, tongues lolling, eyes pecked by gulls. Eard walked alongside the gelding.
"Hush," she said when he wickered. "Hush, Vala. The dead have made their beds upon this sand."
From the looks of things, all the draconic creatures involved in this attack had been killed, either by the war machines or the sword. Sabran would know about it soon. Fortunate for her that her navy was stationed at ports all over Innis, or the whole fleet might have burned. Eard crossed the beach. The wind blew down her hood, cooling the sweat on her brow. Perchling would ordinarily be full of ships, but each one had been set on fire. Those that were intact would need work before they could sail. Only a rowing boat looked untouched. "Lost, are you?" A knife was in her grasp before she knew it, and she spun, poised to throw. A woman held up her hands.
"Easy."
She wore a wide-brimmed hat.
"Easy."
"Who are you, Iskal?"
"Estina Malago, of the Rose Eternal."
The woman cocked an eyebrow.
"You're a little too late to board a ship."
"So I see. The boat is yours, I presume."
"It is."
"Will you take me?" Eard sheathed her knife. "I seek passage to Zeodur." Malago looked her up and down.
"What do I call you?"
"Meg."
"Meg?"
Her smile said she knew full well it was an alias. "From your filthy cloak, I'd say you've been riding hard for a few days. Not much sleep either by the looks of you." "You would ride hard if the Nighthawk wanted your head." Malago grinned, showing a tiny gap between her front teeth.
"Another enemy of the Nighthawk. He ought to start paying us."
"What do you mean?"
"Oh, nothing."
Malago motioned to the horizon.
"The ship is out there. I'd usually expect coin for safe passage, but perhaps with so many worms in the sky, we should all be kinder to each other."
Soft words for a pirate. "Piracy was more of a necessity than a choice for me, Meg." Malago eyed Vala. "You can't take that horse."
"The horse," Eard said, "goes where I go."
"Don't make me leave you behind, Meg." When Eard kept her hand on Vala, Malago folded her arms and sighed. "We'll have to bring the ship in. The captain will expect compensation for that, if not for you." Eard tossed her the purse. Innish money would be useless in the south.
"I take no charity, pirate," she said.
It would not take long to reach Mentendon. Eard lay in her berth and tried to sleep. When she did, she was pierced by unquiet dreams of Sabran and the faceless cupbearer. When she did not, she padded to the deck and gazed at the crystal stars above the sails, letting them calm her mind. The captain, Gian Harlow, stepped from his cabin to smoke his pipe. This was the man who had loved the Queen Mother, according to rumour. Dark eyes, a stern mouth, pockmarks on his brow and cheeks. He looked as if he had been carved by the sea wind. The gazes met across the ship, and Harlow nodded. Eard returned the gesture. At first light, the sky was a smear of ash, and Zeodur was on the horizon. This was where Trude had spent her childhood, where she had first conceived her perilous ideas. It was here that the death of Albrecht Leevelin had been written in the stars. Estina Milargo joined Eard at the bow. "Be careful out there," she said. "It's a hard ride from here to the Aesir, and there are worms in those mountains."
"I fear no worm," Eard nodded to her.
"Thank you, Milargo. Farewell."
"Farewell, Meg."
Milargo pulled down the brim of her hat and turned away. "Safe travels." Flanked by the sea and the river Hundert, the port of Zeodur was shaped like an arrowhead. Canals hatched the northern quarter, lined with elegant houses and elm trees. Eard had passed through the city only once before, when she and Chassar had sailed for Innis. Here, the houses were built in traditional Mentish style, with bell gables. The crocketed spire of the port sanctuary reached up from the heart of the city. It was the last sanctuary she would see for some time. She mounted Valor and spurred him past the markets and book peddlers towards the salt road that would lead her to the capital. In a few days, she would be in Brigstad, and then she would be on her way to the Aesir, far away from the court she had deceived for so long, from the west, and from Sabran. Part 3. A Witch to Live. The bay trees in our country are all withered, and meteors fright the fixed stars of heaven. William Shakespeare. Chapter 38. East. A bell rang, full-throated every morning at first light. On hearing it, the scholars of Feather Island folded away their bedding and proceeded to the bathhouse. Once they had washed, they would eat together, and then, before the elders woke, they would have an hour for prayer and reflection. That hour was her favourite time of day. She knelt before the image of the great Quirky. Water trickled down the walls of the underground cavern and dripped into a pool. Only a lantern fended off the dark. This statue of the great elder was not like those she had prayed before in Psyche. This one showed him with parts of some of the forms he had taken in his lifetime. The antlers of a stag, the talons of a bird, and the tail of a snake. It was some time before Tanne became aware of the clunk of an iron leg on rock. She rose to see the learned Elder Farah standing at the entrance to the grotto.
"Scholar Tanne," he inclined his head, "forgive me for disturbing your reflection."
She bowed in return. Elder Farah was thought by most of the residents of Vane Hall to be an eccentric sort, a thin man with weathered brown skin and crow footprints around his eyes. He always had a smile and a kind word for her. His chief duty was to protect and manage the repository, but he also acted as a healer when the need arose.
"I would be honoured if you would join me at the repository this morning," he said. "Someone else will see to your chores, and please," he added, "take your time."
Tanne hesitated. "I am not permitted in the repository."
"Well, you are today."
He was gone before she could answer. Slowly, she knelt again. This cavern was the only place where she could forget herself. It was one of a honeycomb of grottos behind a waterfall, shared between the Psychonese scholars on this side of the aisle. She fanned out the incense and bowed to the statue. Its jewel eyes glinted at her. At the top of the steps, she emerged into daylight. The sky was a yellow of unbleached silk. She picked her way barefoot across the stepping stones. Feather Island, lonely and rugged, lay far away from anywhere. Its steep cliff faces, an ever-present hood of cloud, presented an imposing front to any ship that dared come near. Snakes lazed on its stony beaches. It was home to people from all over the east, and to the bones of the great Quirky, who was said to have laid himself to rest at the bottom of the ravine that divided the island, which was called the Path of the Elder. It was also said that his bones kept the island wreathed in fog, for a dragon continued to attract water long after its death. It was why Psyche was so misty. Psyche. Windward Hall stood on Cape Quill to the north, while Vane Hall, the smaller, where Tanne had been placed, was set high on a long-dead volcano, surrounded by forest. There were ice caves just behind it, where lava had once flowed. To get between the hermitages, one had to take a rickety bridge across the ravine. There were no other settlements. The scholars were alone in the vastness of the sea. The hermitage was a puzzle box of knowledge. Each new piece of wisdom was earned with understanding of the last. Ensconced in its halls, Tane had learned first about fire and water. Fire, the element of the winged demons, required constant feeding. It was the element of war and greed and vengeance, always hungry, never satisfied. Water needed no coal or tinder to exist. It could shape itself to any space. It nourished flesh and earth and asked for nothing in return. That was why the dragons of the east, lords of rain and lake and sea, would always triumph over the fire breathers. When the ocean had swallowed the world and humankind was washed away, still they would abide. A fish hawk snatched a bitterling from the river. A chill wind soughed between the trees. The autumn dragon would soon return to her slumber, and the winter dragon would wake in the 12th lake. As she stepped onto the roofed walkway that led back to the hermitage, Tane wrapped her cloth hood over her hair, which she had cut short before she had left Ginnura, so it grazed her collarbones. Medushi Tane had long hair. The ghost she had become did not. After reflection, she would usually sweep the floors, help gather fruit from the forest, clear the graves of leaves or feed the chickens. There were no servants on Feather Island, so the scholar shared the menial duties, with the young and strong body taking the most. Strange that Elder Vara had asked her to come to the repository, where the most important documents were kept. When she had arrived on Feather Island, she had taken to her room and lain there for days. She had not eaten a morsel or spoken a word. They had stripped her of her weapons in Ginnura, so she had torn herself apart within. All she had wanted was to mourn her dream until she breathed no more. It was Elder Vara who had shaken a semblance of life back into her. When she had grown weak with hunger, he had coaxed her into the sunshine. He had shown her flowers she had never seen. The next day, he prepared a meal for her, and she had not wanted to disappoint him by leaving it untouched. Now the other scholars called her the ghost of Vane Hall. She could eat and work and read like the rest of them, but her gaze was always in a world where Sousa still lived. Tane stepped off the walkway and made for the repository. Only the elders were usually permitted to enter it. As she approached its steps, Feather Island rumbled. She dropped to the ground and covered her head. As the earthshake rattled the hermitage, she hissed through her teeth in sudden pain. The knot in her side was a knife point. Cold pain, the bite of ice against bare skin, freeze burn in her innards. Tears jolted into her eyes as waves of agony pitched through her. She must have dipped out of consciousness. A gentle voice called her back.
Tane. Paper-dry hands took her arms. Scholar Tane, can you speak?
Yes, she tried to say, but nothing came out.
The earthshake had stopped. The pain had not. Elder Vara scooped her into his bony arms. It chagrined her to be lifted like a child, but the pain was more than she could stand. He took her into the courtyard, behind the repository, and set her on a stone bench behind the fish pond. A kettle waited at its edge.
I was going to take you for a walk on the cliffs today, he said,
but I see now that you need to rest. Another time. He poured tea for both of them. Are you in pain? Her ribcage felt packed with ice.
An old injury. It is nothing, Elder Vara.
Her voice was husky. These earthshakes come so often now.
Yes, it is as if the world wants to change its shape like the dragons of old.
She thought of her conversations with the great Nyamathan. As she tried to steady her breathing, Elder Vara took a seat beside her.
I am afraid of earthshakes, he confessed. When I still lived in Psyche, my mother and I would huddle in our little house in Basai when the ground trembled, and we would tell each other stories to keep our minds off it.
Tane tried to smile. I do not remember if my mother did the same.
As she spoke, the ground shook again.
Well, Elder Vara said, perhaps I could tell you one instead, in keeping with tradition.
Of course.
He handed her a steaming cup. Tane accepted it in silence.
In the time before the Great Sorrow, a fire-breather flew to the Empire of the 12 Lakes and ripped the pearl from the throat of the Spring Dragon, she who brings flowers and soft rains. The winged demons like nothing more than to greedily amass treasure, and no treasure is worth more than a dragon pearl. Though she was badly wounded, the Spring Dragon forbade anyone from pursuing the thief for fear they might also be hurt. But a girl decided she would go. She was 12 years old, small and quick, and so light on her feet that her brothers called her Little Shadow Girl. As the spring dragon mourned for her pearl, a most unnatural winter fell over the land. Though the cold burned her skin and she had no shoes, the little shadow girl walked to the mountain where the fire breather had buried its hoard. While the beast was away, hunting, she stole into its cave and took back the pearl of the spring dragon. It would have been a heavy treasure to bear. The smallest dragon pearl was as big as a human skull. The fire breather returned just as she laid hands upon the pearl. Enraged, it snapped its jaws at the thief who had dared enter its lair and tore a piece of flesh from her thigh. The girl dived into the river, and the current whisked her away from the cave. She escaped with the pearl, but when she pulled herself out of the water, she could find nobody who would stitch her wound, for the blood made people fear that she had the red sickness. Tane watched Eldevara through tendrils of steam. What happened to her? She died at the feet of the spring dragon, and as the flowers bloomed once more, and the sun thawed the snow, the spring dragon declared that the river the little shadow girl had swum in would be named in her honor, for the child had reunited her with the pearl that was her heart. It is said that her ghost wanders its banks, protecting travelers. Never had Tane heard a tale of such bravery from an ordinary person. There are some who find the story sad, others who find it to be a beautiful example of self-sacrifice, Eldevara said. Another shock went through the ground, and inside Tane, something called out in answer. She tried to keep the pain from her face, but Eldevara was too sharp of eye. Tane, he said, may I see this old injury? Tane lifted her tunic just enough for him to see the scar. In the daylight, it looked more prominent than usual. May I? Eldevara asked. When she nodded, he touched it with one finger and frowned. There is a swelling underneath. It was hard as a pebble. My teacher said it happened when I was a child, Tane said, before I came to the houses of learning. You never saw a doctor then, to see if something could be done? She shook her head and covered the scar. I think we should open your side, Tane, Eldevara said decisively. Let me send for the Psychonese doctor who attends us. Most growths of this sort are harmless, but occasionally they can eat away at the body from within. We would not want you to die needlessly, child, like the little shadow girl. She did not die needlessly, Tane said, her gaze blank. With her dying breath, she restored the joy of a dragon, and, in doing so, restored the world. Is there a more honorable thing to do with a life?
Chapter 39 South. A caravan of 40 souls was weaving through the desert. In the faint light of sundown, the sand glittered. Bestriding a camel, Eyadaz Uknara watched the sky deepen to red. Her skin had tanned to a deep brown, and her hair, cut to the shoulders, was covered by a white paw. The caravan she had joined at the place of doves was now in the northern reaches of Birla, the stretch of desert that rolled towards Rumilabar. The Birla was the domain of the Nurum tribes. The caravan had already crossed paths with some of their merchants, who had shared their supplies and warned that worms had been venturing beyond the mountains, doubtless emboldened by rumours that another High Western had been sighted in the east. Eid had stopped at the buried city on her way to Rorka. The Dreadmount, birthplace of wormkind, had been as terrible as she remembered it, jutting like a broken sword into the sky. Once or twice, as she walked between crumbled pillars, she had glimpsed the distant flicker of wings at its summit. Wyverns flocking to their cradle of life. In the shadow of the mountain were the remains of the once great city of Gulfaga. What little was left on the surface belied the structure beneath. Somewhere inside, Janot Utziadur had met his end in the pursuit of knowledge. Eid had considered following him, to see if she could find out more about this long-haired star, the comet that balanced the world. She had scoured the ruins for the route he had used to burrow under the petrified ash. After hours of searching, she had been close to giving up when she saw a tunnel, barely wide enough to crawl in. It was choked by a rockfall. There would be little point in exploring. After all, she knew no Gulfarganian, but Trude's prophecy was a worm in her ear. She had thought her return to the south would breathe life back into her.
Indeed, her first step into the desert of the unquiet dream had felt like a rebirth. Having left Vala safe in the Harmer Pass, she trekked alone through the sands to Rorka. Seeing the city again restored her strength, but it was soon lashed away by the winds that blazed off the Birla. Her skin had forgotten the touch of the desert. All she was now was another dusty traveller, and her memory was a mirage. Some days, she almost believed that she had never worn fine silks and jewels in the court of the Western Queen, that she had never been Ea Durian. A scorpion made a dash past her camel. The other travellers were singing to pass the time. Ea listened in silence. It had been a lifetime since she had heard anyone sing in Assyri. A songbird perched in a cypress tree, and, lonesome, called out for a mate to wed. "Dance, dance," it sang, "on the dunes tonight. Come, come, my love, and we'll both take flight." Rumalabar was still so far away. It would take weeks for the caravan to conquer the Birla in winter, when the bitter nights could kill as swiftly as the sun. She wondered whether Chasar had received word of her departure from Innis, which would have diplomatic ramifications for the Aesir. "We will make for the Nurum camp," the caravan master called. "A storm is coming." The message was passed down the line. Eid held her reins tighter in frustration. She had no time to waste while a storm blew out of the Birla. "Eadaz." She turned in her saddle. Another camel had fallen into step with hers. Ragab was a grizzled post-rider, headed south with a bag of mail. "A sandstorm," he said, his deep voice weary. "I think this journey will never end." Eid enjoyed riding with Ragab, who was full of interesting stories from his travels and claimed to have made the crossing nearly 100 times. He had survived an attack by a basilisk on his village, which had killed his family, blinded him in one eye, and scarred him all over. The other travellers looked at him with pity. They looked at Eid with pity too. She had heard them whisper that she was a wandering spirit in the body of a woman, trapped between worlds. Only Ragab had dared to come close. "I had forgotten how harsh the Birla is," Eid said. "How desolate."
"Have you crossed it before?"
"Twice."
"When you have made the crossing as many times as I have, you will see beauty in that desolation. Though, of all our deserts in Aesir," he said, "the one I like best will always be the Desert of the Unquiet Dream. My favorite story, as a child, was how it received its name."
"That's a very sad tale.
To me, it is beautiful. A tale of love."
Eid reached for her saddle flask. "It has been a long time since I heard it." She removed the stopper. "Perhaps you might tell it to me?"
"If you wish," Ragab said. "We have some way to go."
She let Ragab sip from her flask before she drank herself. He cleared his throat.
"Once there was a king, beloved by his people. He ruled from a blue glass palace in Rorka. His bride, the butterfly queen, who he had loved more than anything in the world, had died young, and he grieved for her pitifully. His officials ruled in his stead while he fell into a prison of his own making, surrounded by wealth he despised. No jewels or coins could buy him the woman he had lost. And so he became known as the Melancholy King. One night, he rose from his bed for the first time in a year to behold the red moon. When he looked down from his window, why, he could not believe his eyes. There was his queen, in the palace gardens, dressed in the same clothes she had worn on the day he wed her, calling to him to join her on the sands. Her eyes were laughing, and she held the rose he had given her when they first met. Thinking himself in a dream, the king walked from the palace, through the city and into the desert, without food or water, without a robe, without even his shoes. He walked and walked, following the shadow in the distance. Even as the cold snaked over his skin, even as he grew weak with thirst and ghouls stalked his footsteps, he told himself, "I am only dreaming. I am only dreaming." He walked after his love, knowing he would reach her, and that he would spend one more night with her, just one more, in his dream at least, before he woke in his bed alone. Eid remembered the next part of the story. A shiver coursed through her. "Of course," Ragab said, "the Melancholy King was not dreaming at all, but following a mirage. The desert had played a trick on him. He died there, and his bones were lost to the sand, and the desert had its name. He patted his camel when it snorted. Love and fear do strange things to our souls. The dreams they bring, those dreams that leave us drenched in salt water and gasping for breath as if we might die, those we call unquiet dreams, and only the scent of a rose can avert them. Gooseflesh freckled-eared as she remembered another rose tucked behind a pillow. The caravan arrived at the camp just as the sandstorm crested the horizon. The travellers were hurried into a central tent, where Eard sat down with Ragab on the cushions, and the Nurum, who were fond of guests, shared their cheese and salted bread. They also passed around a water pipe, which Eard turned down. Ragab, however, was all too pleased to take it.
None of us will sleep well tonight, he blew out a scented plume.
Once the storm is over, we should reach Gordea Oasis in 3 days, by my reckoning. Then the long road lies ahead of us.
Eard gazed at the moon.
How long do these storms last? She asked Ragab.
Ragab shook his head.
Hard to say. It could be minutes, or an hour, or more.
Eard halved around a flatbread with her fingers, as a Nurum woman poured a sweet pink tea for them both. Even the desert conspired against her. She burned to leave the caravan and ride for as long as it took to reach Chassar. But she was not the melancholy king. Fear would not make her take leave of her senses. She was not proud enough to think that she could cross the Birla alone. While the other travellers listened to the story of the blue glass thief of Dreaster, she beat the sand from her clothes and chewed on a soft twig to cleanse her teeth. Then she found a place to sleep, behind a drape. The Nurum would often sleep under the stars, but now, with a sandstorm roaring overhead, they shut themselves into their tents. Gradually, the nomads and their guests began to retire, and the oil lamps were doused. Eard covered herself with a woven blanket. Darkness enwrapped her, and she dreamed herself back to Sabran, flesh aching in remembrance of her touch. Then the mother had mercy, and she slipped into a dreamless sleep. A thump woke her. Her eyes snapped open. The tent shuddered around her, but beneath the tumult, she could hear something outside. Something sure-footed. She slid a dagger from her pack and stepped into the desert night. Sand raged through the camp. Eard held her paw over her mouth. When she saw the silhouette, she flicked her dagger up, sure it was a wyverling. But then it stepped, in all its glory, through the dust of Birla. She smiled. Paspa was the last known Harwiz. White but for their bronze-tipped wings, the bird could grow as large as wyverns, which had bred with them to create the cockatrice. Chassar, who had a fondness for the birds, had found Paspa when she was still in her egg and brought her to the priory. Now she only answered to him. Eard collected her belongings and climbed onto the bird, and soon they left the camp behind. They were fleeing from the rising sun. Eard knew they were getting closer when the salt cedar fingered through the sand, and then, all at once, they were over the domain of Lassia. Her birthplace was a land of red deserts and rugged peaks, of hidden caves and thundering waterfalls, of golden beaches foamed by surf from the Halassa Sea. For the most part, it was a dry country, like the Aesir, but vast rivers flowed through Lassia, and greenery cleaved to them. Looking at the plains below her, Eard felt the homesickness fade at last. No matter how much of the world she saw, she would always believe this was the most beautiful place. Soon, Paspa was soaring over the ruins of Yakala. Eard and Jondu had gone scavenging there many times as children, eager for trinkets from the days of the mother. Paspa banked towards the Lassian Basin. It was this vast and ancient forest, blooded by the river Minara, that cloaked the priory. By the time the sun had risen, Paspa was above its trees, her shadow coasting over the close-knit canopy. The bird finally descended, touching down in one of the few clearings in the forest. Eard slid off her back.
"Thank you, my friend," she said in Selene. "I know the way from here."
Paspa took off without a sound. Eard strode between the trees, feeling as small as one of their leaves. Strangler Fig clambered up their trunks. Her exhausted feet recalled the way, even if her mind had mislaid it. The mouth of the cave was somewhere close, guarded by powerful wardings, hidden in the thickest foliage. It would take her deep into the ground, to the labyrinth of secret halls. A whisper in her blood. She turned.
A woman stood in a pool of sunlight, her belly great with child.
"Nairouge,"
he had said.
"Here does,"
the woman answered.
"Welcome home."
Light splintered through arched lattice windows. Ead became aware that she was in bed, her head supported by silk cushions. The soles of her feet were on fire after so many days on the road. A muffled roar made her sit up. Breathing hard, she groped for a weapon.
Eadas.
Calloused hands cupped hers, startling her.
Eadas, be still.
She stared at the bearded face before her, dark eyes that turned up at the corners, like hers.
Chasar, she whispered. Chasar, is this?
Yes, he smiled. Your home, beloved. She pressed her face against his chest. His robe soaked up the wet on her lashes.
You came a long way.
His hand moved over her sand-crusted hair.
If you had written before you left Ascalon, I could have sent Parsba much sooner.
He had grasped his arm.
I had no time, Chasar, she said. I must tell you, Sabran is in danger, the Duke spiritual. I think they mean to fight her for the throne.
Nothing in Innis matters now. The prioress will speak with you soon. She slept again. When she woke, the sky was the red of dying embers. Lassia remained warm for most of the year, but a chill clung to the evening wind. She rose and wrapped herself in the brocaded robe before walking to the balcony, and she beheld it, the orange tree. It reached up from the heart of the Lassian basin, larger and more beautiful than she had dreamed it in Innis. White flowers dotted its branches in the grass. Around it lay the veil of blood, where the mother had vanquished the nameless one. Ead released her breath. She was home. The underground chambers came to an end in this valley. Only these rooms, the sunrooms, had the privilege of looking over it. The prioress had honored her by allowing her to rest in one. They were usually reserved for prayer and childbirth. 3,000 feet of unbroken water thundered from high above. That was the roar she had heard. Siati Uknara had named the falls the Wail of Galleon to mock his cowardice. Far below her, the river Minara crashed through the valley, feeding the roots of the tree. Her gaze flitted over its labyrinth of branches. Fruit was nestled here and there, rutilant upon the bough. The sight dried her mouth. No water could sate the thirst that throbbed inside her. As she returned to her chamber, she stopped and pressed her brow against the cool, rose-colored stone of the doorway. Home. A low growl lifted the hairs on her nape. She turned to see a full-grown ichneumon in the doorway. Aralak?
Eadas.
His voice was low and stony.
You were a pup when I last saw you.
She could not believe the size of him. Once he had been tiny enough to fit in her lap. Now he was massive and deep-chested, standing a head taller than she was. So were you. Her face softened into a smile. Have you been guarding me all day?
3 days.
The smile faded. 3, she murmured. I must have been more exhausted than I thought.
You have dwelt for too long without the orange tree.
Aralak padded to her side and nosed her hand. Ea chuckled as he rasped his tongue over her face. She remembered him as a squeaking bundle of fur, all eyes and snuffles, tripping over his long tail. One of the sisters had found him orphaned in the Aesir and brought him to the priory, where she and Jondu had been charged with his care. They had fed him on milk and scraps of snake meat.
You should bathe, Aralak licked her fingers. You smell like camel.
Ea tutted. Thank you. You have a certain pungent aroma of your own, you know. She took the oil lamp from her bedside and followed him. He led her through the tunnels and up the flights of steps. They passed 2 Lassian men, sons of Siati, who attended on the sisters. Both dipped their heads as Ead passed. When they reached the bathhouse, Aralak nudged her hip.
Go. A servant will take you to the prioress after.
Golden eyes looked solemnly at her.
Tread lightly around her, daughter of Zala.
His tail swept in his wake as he left. She watched him go before stepping through the doorway into a candle-lit interior. This bathhouse, like the sunrooms, was on the open side of the priory. A breeze swirled the steam on the surface of the water, like spindrift on the sea. Ead set the oil lamp down and shrugged off her robe before descending into the pool. With each step, it carried away sand and dirt and sweat, leaving her sleek and new. She used ash soap to lather her skin. Once she had got the sand from her hair, She let the heat soothe her travel-weary bones.
Tread lightly.
Ichneumons did not give careless warnings. The prioress would want to know why she had been so insistent upon staying in Innis.
You must always stay with me, Ead Darien.
Sister? She turned her head. One of the sons of Siati was in the doorway. The prioress bids you join her for the evening meal, he said. Your garments await you.
Thank you.
In her chamber, she took her time dressing. The garments that had been left to her were not formal, but they befitted her new rank as a postulant. An initiate when she had left for Innis, she had now completed an assignment of consequence for the priory, making her eligible to be named a Red Damsel. Only the prioress could decide if she was worthy of this honour. First was a mantelet of sea silk, which shone like spun gold and covered her to the navel. Next came an embroidered white skirt. A glass band encircled one wrist, the wrist of her sword hand, and strings of wooden beads hung about her neck. She left her hair loose and damp. This new prioress had not seen her since she was 17. As she poured some wine to nerve herself, she caught sight of her reflection in the flat of her eating knife. Full lips, eyes like oak honey, brows set low and straight above them. Her nose was slim at the bridge, broad towards the end. All this she recognized. Yet now she saw, for the first time, how womanhood had changed her. It had tempted out her cheekbones and pared away the rounds of youth. There was a gauntness about her, too, from the kind of starvation only warriors of the priory understood. She looked like the women she had longed to be when she was growing up, like she was made of stone.
Are you ready, sister?
The man was back. He had smoothed her skirt.
Yes, she said. Take me to her.
When Cleolin Dongenu had founded the Priory of the Orange Tree, she had abandoned her life as a princess of the south and disappeared with her handmaidens into the Vale of Blood. They had named their haven in defiance of Galleon. At the time of his coming, knights of the Isles of Inisca had said their vows in buildings called priories. Galleon had planned to found the first southern priory in Yakala.
I shall found a priory of a different sort, Cleolin had said, and no craven knight shall soil its garden.
The mother herself had been the first prioress. The second was Siati Uknara, from whom many of the brothers and sisters of the priory, Ead included, claimed descent. After the death of each prioress, the next one would be chosen by the Red Damsels. The prioress was seated at a table with Chassar. Upon seeing Ead, she rose and took her by the hands.
Beloved daughter, she placed a kiss on her cheek. Welcome back to Lassia.
Ead returned the gesture.
May the flame of the mother sustain you, prioress. And you.
Hazel eyes took her in, noting the changes, before the older woman returned to her seat. Mita Yadanya, formerly the Munguna, the presumed heir, must now be in her fifth decade. She was built like a broadsword, wide in the shoulder and long in the body. Like Ead, she was of both Lassian and Assyri descent, her skin like sand lapped by the sea. Black hair, now threaded with silver, was pierced with a wooden pin. Sarson chirruped a greeting from his perch. Chassar was midway through a concoction of yoghurt and braised lamb. He stopped to smile at her. Ead sat beside him, and a son of Siati set a bowl of groundnut stew before her. Platters of food circled the table. White cheese, honeyed dates, palm apples and apricots, hot flatbread crowned with pounded chickpeas, rice tossed with onion and plum tomato, sun-dried fish, steaming clams, red plantain split and spiced. Taste she had craved for nearly a decade.
A girl left us, and a woman returns, the prioress said, as the son of Siati served Ead as much food as he could fit on her plate. I am loath to hurry you, but we must know the circumstances under which you left Innis. Chassar tells me you were exiled.
I fled to escape arrest. What happened, daughter?
Ead poured from a jug of date palm wine, giving herself a few moments to think. She began with Trude Utziada and her affair with the squire. She told them about Triam Sulliard and his crossing to the east. She told them about the Tablet of Rumalabar and the theory Trude had drawn from it, a story of cosmic balance, of fire and stars.
This may have weight, prioress, Chassar said thoughtfully. There are times of plenty when the tree gives freely. We are in one now, and periods where it offers less fruit.
There have been two such times of scarcity, one of them directly after the grief of ages. This theory of a cosmic balance does something to explain it. The prioress seemed to contemplate this, but did not voice her thoughts.
Continue, Eadas,
she said. Ead did. She told them about the marriage, and the murder, and the child, and the loss of it, about the Duke's spiritual, and what Combe had implied about their intentions towards Sabran. She left out some things, of course. Now she is unable to conceive, her legitimacy is under threat. At least one person in the palace, this cupbearer, has been trying to murder her, or at least frighten her, he had finished. We must send more sisters, or I believe the Duke's spiritual will move towards the throne. Now they know her secret, she is at their mercy. They could use it to blackmail her, or simply usurp her.
Civil war,
the prioress pursed her lips.
I told our last prioress that this would happen sooner or later, but she would not hear it.
She cut into a slice of muskmelon.
We will meddle no more in Inish affairs.
Ead was sure she must have misheard.
Prioress, she said, may I ask what you mean? I mean precisely what I said, that the priory will no longer interfere in Inish.
Confounded, Ead looked to Chazar, but suddenly he was deeply involved in his meal.
Prioress, she fought to keep her voice in hand, you cannot intend to abandon Virtudum to this uncertain fate.
No reply.
If Sabran is revealed to be unable to bear a daughter, there will not only be civil war in Inish, but a dangerous schism will split Virtudum. Different fractions will be for different members of the Duke spiritual. Even the Earl's provincial might try for the throne. Doomsingers will roam the cities. And amidst this chaos, Fyrdell will seize power.
The prioress dipped her fingers into a dish of water, washing away the blood of the muskmelon.
Eadas, she said, the priory of the orange tree is the vanguard against wormkind. It has been that for 1,000 years.
She looked Ead in the eye.
It does not exist to hold up failing monarchies or to interfere in foreign wars. We are not politicians or bodyguards or mercenaries. We are vessels of the sacred flame.
Ead waited.
As Chazar said, there are records that indicate periods of scarcity in the priory. If our scholars have it right, there will be another soon. We are likely to be at war with the Draconic army up to and throughout that period, perhaps with the Nameless One himself, the prioress continued. We must be ready for the cruelest fight since the grief of ages. Consequently, we must concentrate our efforts on the south and conserve resources wherever possible. We must weather the storm. Of course, but therefore,
the prioress cut across her,
I will not be sending any sister into the jaws of a civil war in Virtudum to save a queen who has all but fallen. Neither will I risk them being executed for heresy, not when they could be hunting the High Westerns or supporting our friends in the courts of the south.
Prioress, Ead said, frustrated, surely the purpose of the priory is to protect humankind by defeating the draconic evil in this world.
If we mean to defeat that evil, there must be stability in the world. The priory is the first shield against worms, but we cannot win alone, he had stressed. Virtudum has great military and naval strength. The only way to hold it together and to prevent it from destroying itself from within is to keep Sabran Berethnet alive and enough.
He had said no more. There was a stillness in the room that seemed to go on for hours.
You are strong-willed, Eadas. Like Zala was, the prioress said, softer. I respected our last prioress in her decision to station you in Inish. She believed it was what the mother wanted, but I believe otherwise. It is time to prepare. Time to look to our own and make ready for war.
She shook her head.
I will not see you echoing repugnant prayers in Ascalon for another season.
Then it was all for nothing. Years of changing sheets, Ead said tartly. For nothing. The look the prioress gave her chilled her to the soul.
Chazar cleared his throat. More wine, prioress.
She gave a slight nod in return, and he poured.
It was not for nothing.
The prioress stopped him when her cup was almost full.
My predecessor believed the Berethnet claim might be true, and that the possibility made their queens worthy of protection. But whether they are or are not, you have told us that Sabran is now the last of the line. Virtudum will fall, whether now or in the near future, when her barrenness is exposed.
And the Priory will make no attempt to soften that fall. Eid could not stomach this. You mean to let us stand and watch as half the world descends into chaos? It is not for us to change the natural course of history. The Prioress picked up her glass. We must look to the south now, Eid does, to our purpose. Eid sat rigid in her chair. She thought of Loth and Margaret, innocent children like Tally's. Sabran, alone and bereaved in her tower, all lost. The last Prioress would not have brooked this indifference. She had always believed that the Mother had meant for the Priory to protect and support humankind in all corners of the world.
Fyadel is now awake, the Prioress said, while Eid locked her jaw. His siblings, Helvisa and Kamath, have also been sighted, the former in the east, the latter here in the south. You have told us of this white worm, which we must assume is a new power in league with the others. We must dispatch all four to quench the flame in the draconic army.
Chassa nodded. Where in the south this cometh? Eid asked when she could speak without an outburst. He was last seen close to the gates of Ungulus. The Prioress dabbed the corner of her mouth with linen. A son of Siati took her place.
Eidaz, she said, you have completed an assignment of import for the Priory. It is time, daughter, for you to take the cloak of a red damsel. I have no doubt that you will be one of our finest warriors.
Mita Yadanya was a blunt woman, brisk in everything. She delivered Eid her dream as if it were a piece of fruit on a platter. Her years in Innis had only ever been meant to bring her closer to that cloak. Yet the timing of this was purposeful, and it stuck in her craw. The Prioress was using this to conciliate her, as though she were a child to be distracted by a bauble.
Thank you, Eid said. I am honored.
Eid and Chassar ate in silence for a time, and Eid sipped the cloudy wine.
Prioress, she said at last, I must ask what became of Jandu. Did she ever return to Lassia?
When the Prioress looked away, her mouth a grim line, Chassar shook his head.
No, beloved. He placed a hand over hers. Jandu is with the Mother now.
Something died inside Eid. She had been certain, certain that Jandu would find her way back to the Priory. Sure-footed, fierce, dauntless Jandu. Mentor, sister, constant friend.
Are you sure? She asked quietly.
Yes.
Pain flowered sharply in her midriff. She closed her eyes, imagined that pain as a candle, and snuffed it. Later, she would let the grief burn when there was room for it to breathe.
She did not die in vain, Chassar continued. She set out to find the sword of Galleon the Deceiver. She did not find Ascalon in Innis, but she did find something else.
Sarson tapped a talon on his perch. Numbed by the news, Eid looked dully at the object beside him. A box.
We do not know how to open it, Chassar admitted as Eid stood. A riddle stands between us and its secret.
Slowly, Eid approached the box and ran a finger over the grooves on its surface. What the untaught eye would see as mere decoration, she knew to be Selene, the ancient language of the south, the letters wound and intertwined to make them hard to read. A key without a lock or seam, to raise the sea in times of strife. It closed in clouds of salt and steam, it opens with a golden knife.
I assume you have tried all the knives in the Priory? He had said.
Of course. Perhaps it refers to Ascalon, then.
Ascalon was said to have a silver blade, Chassar sighed. The sons of Siati are searching the archives for an answer.
We must pray they find it, the Prioress said. If Jandu was willing to die to put this box into our possession, she must have felt that we could open it, devoted to the end.
She looked to Eid again. For now, Eid does, you must go forth and eat of the tree. After 8 years, I know your fire is spent. She paused. Would you like one of your sisters to go with you?
No, Eid said. I will go alone.
Evening turned to night. When the stars were burning over the Vale of Blood, Eid began the descent. 1,000 steps took her to the very foot of the valley. Her bare feet sank into grass and loam. She paused for a moment to breathe in the night before she let her robe fall. White blossoms strewed the valley. The orange tree loomed, its branches spread like open hands. Every step she took towards it seared her throat.
She had crossed half the world to return here, to the wellspring of her power. The knight seemed to embrace her as she descended to her knees. As her fingers sank into the earth, the tears of relief overran, and each breath came like the drag of a knife up her throat. She forgot about everyone she had ever known. There was only the tree, the giver of fire. It was her one purpose, her reason to live, and it was calling to her, after 8 years, promising the sacred flame. Somewhere nearby, the prioress, or one of the red damsels, would be watching. They needed to see that she was still worthy of this rank. Only the tree could decide who was worthy. Ea turned up her palms and waited, as the crop waits for rain.
Fill me with your fire again. She held the prayer in her heart. Let me serve you.
The night grew too still. And then, slowly, as if it was sinking through water, a golden fruit dropped from on high. She caught it in both hands. With a gasping sob, she sank her teeth into the flesh. A feeling like dying and coming to life. The blood of the tree spreading over her tongue, soothing the blaze in her throat. Veins turning to gold. As quickly as it quenched one fire, it sparked another. A fire that torched through her whole being, and the heat cracked her open like the clay she was and made her body cry out to the world. All around her, the world answered. Chapter 40 East. Rain sheeted over the Sundance Sea. It was forenoon, but the fleet of the Tiger Eye kept its lanterns burning. Leia Yadaje strode across the pursuit. As he followed her, shivering in his sodden cloak, Nicolaes could not help but glance towards the contused sky, as he had every day for weeks. Helvisa the Harrower was awake. The sight of her above the ships, crowing and infernal, was seared into his mind forever. He had seen enough paintings to know her. With scales of burnt orange and golden spines, she was a living ember, as bright as if she had just been wrenched from the Dreadmount. Now she was back. And at any moment she could reappear and reduce the pursuit to cinders. It might, at least, be quicker than whatever gruesome death the pirates would invent for him if he had the misfortune to vex them. He had been on the treasure ship for weeks, and had so far managed not to have his tongue cut out or a hand lopped off, but he lived in expectation of it. His gaze darted to the horizon. Three Cycones iron ships had tailed them for days, but just as the Golden Empress had predicted, they had not drawn close enough to engage. Now the pursuit was moving east again, heading for Kawente, where the pirates would sell the Lacustrine dragon. Nicolaes wished he knew what they would do to him. Rain speckled his eyeglasses. He rubbed at them fruitlessly and hurried after Leia. The Golden Empress had summoned them both to her cabin, where a stove offset the chill. She stood at the head of the table, wearing a padded coat and a hat of otter fur.
"Sea Moon," she said, "do sit down."
Nicolaes had scarcely opened his mouth since Helvisa had terrified the wits out of him, but now he found himself blurting out,
"You speak Cycones, all honoured captain." "Of course I speak fucking Cycones."
Her gaze was on the table, where a detailed map of the East was painted.
"Did you think me a fool?"
"Well, no, but the presence of your interpreter led me to believe
I have an interpreter so my hostages will think me a fool. Did Yadaji do a poor job?"
"No, no," Nicolaes said aghast. "No, all honoured Golden Empress, she did excellently."
"So you do think me a fool?"
Lost for words, he shut up. She finally looked up at him.
"Sit."
He sat. Eyeing him, the Golden Empress took an eating knife from her belt and ran its tip under her inch-long fingernails, each of which was painted black.
"I have spent 30 years on the high seas," she said. "I have dealt with many manner of people, from fisherfolk to viceroys. I have learned who I need to torture, who I need to kill, and who will tell all their secrets or share their riches with no bloodshed at all."
She spun the knife in her hand.
"Before I was taken hostage by pirates, I owned a brothel in Zophu. I know more about people than they know themselves. I know women. I know men, too, from their minds to their cocks. And I know how to judge them almost on sight."
Nicolaes swallowed. "If we could leave the cocks out of this," he offered a strained grin. "Old as it is, I'm still attached to mine." The Golden Empress barked a laugh at that.
"You are funny, Sea Moon," she said. You people from over the abyss are always laughing. No wonder you have so many jesters in your courts.
Those black eyes bored into him.
I see you. I know what you want, and it has nothing to do with your cock.